Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a faith that, well, it has a really powerful, visible presence around the world, but often gets reduced to, you know, those external symbols. We're talking about Sikhism.
That's right.
And we're diving into Eleanor Nesbitt's excellent book, Sikhism, a very short introduction. It's highly regarded.
It really is. And when you think of Sikhism, like you said, the first images, often it's the turban, maybe the beard, the articles of faith you can see.
Yeah.
But our mission for you today, really using Nesbitt's deep research as our guide, is to move beyond those markers.
Okay.
We want to understand Sikhism as a truly dynamic, profound, and really a living world religion. One that offers quite a unique perspective on modern ethical life.
Okay, let's jump right in then. Why is this knowledge so crucial right now? What's the relevance for us today? Well, I think it's because the core ideas of Sikhism, things like radical social justice, this deep spiritual commitment combined with practical ethical living, they're just so relevant to today's global challenges, aren't they?
Definitely.
It was founded on this idea that spirituality and engagement with the world, they're actually inseparable. You can't divide the sacred and the secular.
Right.
And that offers a framework for thinking about global identity, about interfaith understanding.
Right.
It's quite powerful.
That tension, or maybe that integration between spiritual focus and worldly action, is fascinating. Before we get into the real nuts and bolts of the theology, maybe we should establish who Eleanor Nesbitt is, why she's the right guide for this journey.
Good idea. Well, Nesbitt is a professor emerita in religions and education at the University of Warwick. She's a really distinguished scholar specializing in South Asian religions.
Okay.
But her real strength, and what makes this particular book so valuable, I think, is the way she combines really deep historical research with extensive ethnographic fieldwork.
So she's not just, you know, sitting in a library reading ancient texts. She's acting more like a social anthropologist.
Exactly. She spent decades, literally decades, working directly with Sikh communities. Particularly in the UK, but internationally, too.
Right, right.
And that gives her this unique perspective. It's objective, sure, because she's an academic, but it's also deeply empathetic. She doesn't just explain what the doctrine says. She shows how that doctrine actually translates into daily life, into community organization, into how identity evolves across generations.
Ah, okay.
It's the lived experience, you see, that really drives her analysis.
And that lived perspective, I imagine, informs the book's core idea that Sikhism has to be understood as this integrated whole.
That's precisely the central argument. You can't just cherry pick the theology or look only at the history of the 10 gurus or just the scripture or only the community practices. They're all interwoven deeply. Yeah.
And what's really critical here, as the book emphasizes quite strongly, is that Sikhism is not just some blend or, you know, a hybrid of Hinduism and Islam. That's a common simplification, isn't it?
A very common one, yes. But she argues it's a distinct and original spiritual path established by Guru Nanak back in 15th century Punjab.
And that distinction starts with?
It's rooted in this radical monotheism. The foundational concept is Ik Onkar, the one formless creator.
Ik Onkar.
Okay. And if the creator is truly one and formless, well, then all that ritualism, the social hierarchy, idolatry, it all becomes fundamentally pointless, you see.
Right. It cuts through all of that.
Exactly.
So starting with that pretty revolutionary concept in the 15th century, the book then traces how the faith evolves systematically. Where does Nesbitt take us next?
Well, she traces the path through the next nine gurus, the successors to Guru Nanak. They develop the community, both institutionally and spiritually. This leads up to the creation of the Khalsa, which is a really key moment.
Khalsa, right.
And then she moves quite swiftly into the 21st century, looking at the challenges and, frankly, the remarkable adaptability of the global Sikh diaspora, you know, communities in North America, Europe, all over the world.
Okay, let's dig into that foundation first. Guru Nanak's spiritual revolution. You said he was challenging the status quo. What was the central path he actually laid out?
Well, his path directly attacked the caste system, the empty ritualism of his time. Instead, he focused on internal transformation. And he boiled it down to three core pillars, really.
Three pillars?
Yeah. Spiritual contemplation, meditating on the divine name, that's named Simran. Then ethical conduct, earning an honest living, that's a Kirtkarni. and finally, sharing what you earn with the community, Vanchakna.
Nam Simran Kiratkarni Vanchakna.
Right. So it was a faith geared towards practical ethical action right from the very start.
And that focus on equality, on sharing, it must have shaped the community's institutions almost immediately.
Absolutely. The gurus who followed built directly on this foundation. For instance, Guru Amar Das, the third guru, he established the Langar, the free community kitchen, as a mandatory institution.
Mandatory.
Yes, mandatory. Designed specifically to break down social barriers. Everyone rich, poor, high caste, low caste, man, woman must sit together side by side and eat the same food. It's a powerful equalizer.
Wow. And then Guru Ram Dass founded Amritsar.
That's right, the fourth guru. He consolidated the community further by founding the city of Amritsar, which became and still is the spiritual center.
Okay, and then came a really pivotal moment under the fifth guru, Guru Arjan Dev. How did his life, and particularly his death, change things?
Guru Arjan Dev, his contribution was immense. He compiled the Adi Granth, the first definitive collection of sacred scriptures, the precursor to the Guru Granth Sahib.
The holy book?
Exactly. But then his subsequent torture and martyrdom under the Mughal Empire.
Yeah.
That marked a really critical shift. Nisbet highlights this as sort of the end of a purely pacifist phase for the community.
So resistance became necessary.
It seems so. The community realized that deep spiritual commitment, while essential, wasn't always enough. They needed the means to actually defend their faith, defend their people against tyranny and oppression.
And this sounds like the direct lead-in to the famous saint soldier ideal, right? Under Guru Gobind Singh, the 10th guru, he created the Khalsa.
Precisely. The Khalsa, often translated as the community of the pure, was established in 1699. It was designed to be this disciplined, even martial, yet deeply spiritual body, committed to justice and righteous defense.
And he introduced the famous 5Ks.
Yes, the Panch Kakar. He established the profound symbolism of the 5Ks. Kesh, uncut hair, signifying spirituality and acceptance of God's will. Kirpan, a sword or dagger for defensive justice in the weak. Kara, a steel bracelet, symbolizing restraint and connection to God. Kachira, special cotton undergarment, representing chastity and readiness. And Kanga, a wooden comb for cleanliness and discipline.
Why those specific symbols? Were they just identifiers?
Well, they were more than that. They weren't optional accessories. They were, and are, articles of faith, intended to unify the community, instill discipline, readiness. The kirpan, for example, isn't just about physical strength. It's a constant reminder of the duty to uphold justice, to protect the vulnerable.
So they're external markers of an internal commitment.
Exactly. An internal commitment to that miri-piri concept we touched on earlier.
Ah, yes. Miri-piri. Remind us what that is again.
It's this essential balance. Miri represents temporal, worldly authority and responsibility. Piri represents spiritual authority and consciousness.
So not separate, but balanced.
Perfectly balanced.
Yeah.
It completely rejects the idea that you have to withdraw from the world, become an ascetic, to be pious or spiritual.
The saint soldier embodies both.
Yes. The ideal insists you must be an active, ethical participant in society. But you use your spiritual consciousness to guide your worldly power and actions. And this whole ideal, this miri-piri concept, it informed Guru Gobind Singh's final, really defining act regarding where ultimate authority would lie.
Right. Instead of appointing another human guru to succeed him,
he declared the holy scripture, the collection compiled by Guru Arjan Dev, and expanded, now called the Guru Granth Sahib, as the eternal guru, his successor forever.
Wow. So the authority shifted from a person to the text.
Precisely. You could call it a democratization of spiritual authority. It ended the line of human gurus and established the Shabad, the divine word, the wisdom contained within the scripture, as the ultimate, sovereign, and eternal guide for the entire Sikh community.
So the authority resides not in a personality cult, but in the collective wisdom held within the text.
Exactly. Which is why the Guru Granth Sahib is treated with such immense reverence in the Gurdwara, the seat place of worship.
And this scripture then forms the absolute core of community life, centered around the Gurdwara. You mentioned the Langar earlier. How does Nesbitt describe its function today? Is it still central?
Oh, absolutely central. It remains this incredibly powerful living expression of seva.
Seva meaning?
Selfless service. Nesbitt points out that the langar is, well, it's kind of a revolutionary social tool. It's not just about getting a free meal. It's a mandated practice of radical hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is welcome. Everyone eats together, demonstrating practically that all those distinctions, caste, wealth, status, they just dissolve the moment you enter that sacred space.
It's equality in action daily.
Every single day. and gurdwaras all over the world.
Okay, let's shift focus a bit, moving towards the present day. The journey of Sikhism from its roots in Punjab to becoming a truly global religion with major centers in Canada, the UK, the US, that's defined modern Sikhism, hasn't it? What challenges does Nesbitt highlight for this diaspora?
Yeah, that global shift brings complexity. Maintaining identity is a big one. How do you ensure intergenerational transmission, you know, of the Punjabi language, of cultural practices, when you're thousands of miles away?
And dealing with external perceptions, I imagine.
Huge challenge. Dealing with misunderstanding, ignorance. Nesbitt notes the really painful reality, especially after 9/11, where the visible symbols, like the turban, led to Sikhs being wrongly identified and, tragically, facing increased racism, discrimination, even hate crimes.
That's a heavy burden. Does she also touch on internal debates or tensions within the global community itself?
She does, yes. She briefly discusses sensitive issues like political aspirations, the Khalistan movement, for example, and interestingly, the persistent influence of caste within some diaspora communities, even though it's theologically rejected by Sikhism at its core.
So it shows Sikhism isn't some static textbook religion. It's vibrant, living, grappling with its history, its principle, and the pressures of modernity.
Exactly. And Nesbitt's work offers immense insight into how faith communities adapt, how they navigate change, while trying desperately to hold on to their core principles.
Okay, let's try and synthesize some of this. What are the core messages or themes we should really take away, maybe linking them to our own lives? The first one seems clear. This radical demand for equality and social justice flowing directly from Ek Onkar.
Absolutely. If there's only one formless creator, then logically, all of creation, all humans, are equally divine. So barriers based on caste, gender, race, they aren't just social problems. They're fundamentally spiritual errors.
That was revolutionary in the 15th century.
Hugely revolutionary. And think about the application for us today, right? Mm. It really forces us to actively look at our own assumptions, our own implicit biases, the structural barriers we might just accept in our workplaces, our communities. Mm. The standard for social action was set centuries ago.
It's a high bar. Okay, what's the second key theme?
That integrated theme of Miri Piri we discussed. The union of the spiritual and the worldly. Sikhism demands active engagement. It rejects withdrawal or asceticism. The ideal is to earn an honest living, raise a family, participate in society, but do it all guided by spiritual truth and ethical consciousness.
The Saint Soldier ideal again, but maybe applied more broadly to, say, professional life today. How can we translate that into something practical for listeners?
Well, think about the concepts of Kirat Karni, ethical earning, coupled with Van Chakna, sharing your resources. That's the blueprint. So a practical tip might be, see your professional success, your skills, your income, not just as an end in itself, not just for accumulation, but as a resource to be ethically cultivated, yes, but also shared. It's a kind of deliberate antidote to pure greed or consumerism.
Asking yourself, is my work actually serving my community in some way? Does it align with my values?
Exactly. It reframes success away from just accumulation towards contribution and ethical living.
Powerful. And finally, let's revisit that core principle of seva.
Yes, seva, selfless service. That's the third core takeaway. In Sikhism, it's considered one of the highest forms of worship. And it's also seen as the most effective way to overcome the ego, the sense of I-ness or hamai, which Sikh thought considers the root of suffering.
So how can we apply the spirit of seva and maybe the langar model in our own lives, even if we're not Sikh?
Well, think about that idea of radical hospitality. The langar shows us that shared, barrier-free experiences are incredibly potent social tools. They break down walls. So a practical tip, intentionally try to foster more inclusive, barrier-free spaces in your own environment.
How?
It could be simple things, sharing a meal, maybe organizing a community event where everyone feels welcome, or just actively reaching out across social or professional divides in your own life without expecting anything back. It's about connection, service, reducing that ego.
Reducing barriers through simple shared experiences. I like that. The power of these ideas really comes through in some of the quotes or key concepts Nesbitt highlights. Let's maybe look at three that really ground the philosophy. First, Guru Nanak's very pragmatic challenge. Truth is high, but higher still is truthful living.
Ah, yes. That encapsulates so much. Nesbitt interprets this as underscoring the absolute primacy of ethical conduct. Belief, theology. It's basically meaningless if you don't actually embody that truth in your daily actions. Through honesty, compassion, integrity, living the truth is higher than just knowing it.
Actions speak louder than words, essentially.
Fundamentally, yes.
Yeah.
Then there's the universal commitment from Guru Gobind Singh. recognize the whole human race as one.
That sounds like the justification for langer.
It absolutely is. It's the philosophical bedrock for rejecting all distinctions, caste, creed, race, gender, and for creating universal institutions like the langer, the clear mandate for recognizing our shared single humanity.
Very clear. And finally, that structural idea we discussed. The word is the guru, and the guru is the word, the concept of Shabad Guru.
Right. This explains the profound reverence for the Guru Granth Sahib. It is the eternal, living guru, the divine wisdom itself. The Shabad was transferred from a line of human beings to the sacred text, providing this incredible continuity and stability for the community across centuries and continents. The guidance is always there in the word.
That's quite profound. Thinking back on Nesbitt's introduction, what I found most surprising, or perhaps illuminating, was the clarity with which she explained the necessity behind the formation of the Khalsa. It wasn't just, you know, an arbitrary decision. It felt like a very practical spiritual response to real political persecution. That balance she draws out between strength and deep spirituality in the Miri-Piri concept is incredibly compelling.
I agree. And for me, the lasting synthesis, the most valuable lesson, perhaps, is that spiritual development and social engagement aren't competing priorities in Sikhism. They're completely complementary aspects of an authentic religious life.
Two sides of the same coin.
Exactly. Sikhism provides this powerful living demonstration that genuine spirituality can't be passive. It must manifest in the world. Through practical service, through ethical living, and through an unwavering commitment to stand up for justice.
A really profound and, as you say, practical deep dive today. Thank you.
It was truly illuminating to revisit Nesbitt's work.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.